Welcome to Disruptive Successor, a show for next generation leaders in family businesses and entrepreneurs who want to disrupt the status quo and take their existing business to a whole new level. We all know that what got us here isn't going to get us there. This show will provide inspiration, advice, and resources to help you create massive impact.
This podcast is sponsored by myself, Jonathan Goldhill, and my company, The Goldhill Group, where we provide coaching for growing companies. I'm Jonathan Goldhill, and my purpose is simple: to guide entrepreneurial leaders in family businesses towards more freedom and fulfillment. I want entrepreneurs to get clarity around the changes that will make them and their businesses more successful so they can experience the same freedom I've enjoyed in my life. Our proven practices challenge business owners to think differently about their business and how they're running it, and quite literally become game changers in our clients' companies. Learn more at thegoldhillgroup.com website, where you can schedule your free strategy session. Hi, Jonathan Goldhill here, and welcome back to another episode of the Disruptive Successor Show. And today's guest is Alice Hyman. Alice is nationally known for her expertise in elevating sales to increase valuation for companies with a B2B sale that have exceptional growth potential. Spending her time strategizing with CEOs and their leadership team to build the strategies that find new business and grow existing accounts is her passion. Her clients love her spirit and the way she energizes their sales organization. Alice, welcome to my show today.
Thank you. I'm excited. You and I have talked several times, but never on the podcast. So I'm excited to share with your audience.
Yeah. So we're going to talk today mostly about the CEO's role in sales organizations and building sales organizations, challenges that you see with customer engagement, and really how a CEO can take a role in ensuring the entire company is providing an exceptional customer experience. But I want to start with a little bit of your history. And this is really about credibility of who you are and how you got started in this whole thing, which is I recognized you from the name Miller Hyman, which was a very well-known and respected business, family-owned business in the sales training space. So give us a little history of that organization, if you would.
Yeah, well, my dad is Steve Hyman, and his partner, Bob Miller, who is no longer with us, unfortunately. They started in the 70s, in the late 70s, when I was still in college, and they had been both selling for many years. They had met when I was like 3 years old. They worked for a company called Kepner Trigo, and then it was some type of consulting firm. And then my dad was a VP of sales for several different companies and worked his way up through that. And the last company he ended up working for was in California. And both of them started in the East Coast, migrated to the West Coast. Bob Miller happened to be in California at the same time. And my dad decided he didn't want to work for that company anymore. So he had, you know, re-met up with Bob, and Bob said, well, I'm doing this consulting thing, helping people learn, you know, how to do sales better. You want to do that with me? And so they just got together and on Union Street in San Francisco, in a little, like around Union and Steiner, this little three-story walk-up, and they had this little office in there, and that's where it all began. And they were just out there talking to sales leadership of companies and helping them understand that there is a process to selling, and that if people follow the process, if the salespeople follow that process, then they're going to have more wins. And indeed, that is true still today. If you follow the processes that they built, you will definitely have more wins. And so that's how the company was born. And then my dad bought Bob Miller out in like 1989, and they were still in the Bay Area. They decided to move to Reno, Nevada, which is where I am now, in the beautiful Sierra Nevada mountains near Lake Tahoe. And my dad and my stepmom grew the business from there. And I joined them after spending 13 years as a public school teacher. We won't even go there. But anyway, I have a master's degree in education, not in business. Mm-hmm. And I started to work for them in the early 90s when they really wanted to have the company grow substantially and then eventually exit, which they did have a successful exit in 1998.
So we talked a little bit about this, but let's share for those who are listening. So was there a point in time where they were considering succession planning in their business that you were aware of? Or was it just like, let's exit this company. We don't really have a successor or a successive team. What was the discussion or lack thereof in your household?
Yes. So just so everybody knows, I'm one of seven. Mm-hmm. So my dad and stepmom between them have seven children. And so this business had some of the family working in it at different times, even while I was in college. And when I had graduated and was working as a teacher, I was doing projects for the company. My younger sister, two of my younger sisters worked there for a time. One of my younger sister's husbands worked there for a time. My a younger brother had worked there. So there was some family involved, but they weren't in leadership roles necessarily. I was in a semi-leadership role while I was there. There was never really any discussion about succession. I wouldn't even have known what that was at the time, to be honest with you. And I was, you know, probably in my early 30s. And there was a lot of discussion about how to make improvements, how to grow the company, how to give an exceptional customer experience to our customers, and how to guide our independent contractors who sold and delivered. So there was always a lot of talk about improving and making things better. And I'll tell you what I remember really about my parents is my dad didn't want to run the company anymore. And my stepmom said she would take a try at it, and she would try to run the company. And she used to say to us when we would be in our planning meetings and stuff, and just like, I know how to run a $5 million company, but do I know how to run a $10 million company? Because that's where we're going next, right? And then she'd say, you know, we get to $10 million. It'd be like, I'm doing pretty good running a $10 million company. You know, we've had to make some changes. You know, we talk about it then, but do I know how to run a $20 million company? And so I love that they were always growing and learning and asking themselves those hard questions, because I think it's true about founders. You get to a point where your company outgrows you. It's like, it was great when it was little, I knew how to run it, but you know, not only do I not know how to run it? I don't even want to do that anymore, because I liked running a smaller company. And I think that's one of the signals that you do need to do succession planning and start seeing who you're going to bring up to run it, because you don't want to anymore, don't feel like you have the capabilities anymore. And, or that's when the signal is time to sell, right? Because you're not going to do it anymore. So I think, anyway, those signals were there, but they weren't saying sell. But if I had known what I know now, I would have known those signals meant sell, because there was no obvious successor. I was the oldest one and the most involved in the business at the time. And I did not have I didn't have the knowledge or the experience to run that company without their help. And they wanted to be completely out. So they wanted to sell. And my dad tells me now, you know, he's in his 80s. He says, you know, really all I was thinking is I want to preserve our wealth. And so I don't want anybody fighting over the company. And so I just wanted to sell it and be done and not have to think about it anymore. And I knew if one of you kids ran the company, all these other things were an option that he wasn't interested in having happen.
That's a great insight you just shared. So when there's a lot, multiple children involved, it's so much easier for a parent to just say, you know what, let's just exit. Let's take this option off the table for the children. It's our money. We built the business.
Right.
We'll probably split our money evenly when we pass, but we're not giving them the business now and having to make decisions about, well, this person's not in the business. This one is in the business. How are we going to divvy it up? So,
Right. And for anyone who has a family business, you know that you are always talking about your business when you're together, right? So like at Christmas dinner, I'd be like, stop talking about business, you know? And so even let's say there was a succession plan. And, you know, my dad would still have to be the advisor. And so would my stepmom, and they would, we'd still be talking about it. And I think they just wanted that to, you know, be
gone. So that's great. So let's get into your chapter then. So, but let's first clarify, Miller Hyman training was the sort of gold standard, platinum, if you will, standard for sales training for who? Was it Fortune 1000 corporations?
Yes.
Was it mostly that?
Fortune 1000, a lot of Fortune 500, and you know, even the Fortune 10. We had the largest companies in the world using our training, but it's specifically for companies who have a complex sale.
Right.
Now, that's not every company. So it's business to business,
right?
Complex sale. There's a lot of business to consumer this wouldn't apply to.
Yep.
And there's business to business that it wouldn't necessarily completely apply to, because in a complex sale, you have a very long sales cycle for many reasons. There's multiple people involved on the buyer's side, multiple people on the seller's side. There's high dollar stakes. There's lots of competitors. There's technical complexities, integration complexities, things like that. So it's going to make the sale longer because of all these things. And it's going to be more complex because so many people have to come together to make the decision. And that's a lot of work orchestrating all of that. So that's what Miller Hyman does best, is help with the process around a complex sale.
Great.
So
let's just contrast that with another sales training program, one that maybe a lot of listeners that I know are familiar with, a lot of my colleagues are familiar with, and I've been through it myself, and that's Sandler sales training program, which is both B2B and B2C, and it's not complex sales necessarily, but they probably have some foothold in that. So contrast the Sandler, if you could.
Well, I think, you know, there's some skills that every salesperson needs. Look someone in the eye when you talk to them, ask good questions, listen to the answers, formulate ideas, collaborate. You know, how do you do those things? How do you prepare for a sales meeting? How do you move the sale forward? You know, so you prepare for the sales meeting, ask your questions, take your notes, do your follow-up. What's the next step? You know, these are things every salesperson needs to know how to do, you know, how to meet all the different people that are going to make the decision. Even if there's just two people, you've got to get to know both of them, and how to, you know, build a relationship with somebody whose style is different than yours. And so many training programs, including Sandler's, teach you these basic, how to prepare for a sales call, how to ask good questions, how to figure out who you should have a meeting with, and even the types of questions you should ask, and how to do good follow-up, things like that. They also may teach you something about time management and how your opportunity flow and how to track opportunities. They may teach you those kinds of things as well. And some of those things are in the Miller Hyman programs, because there's a program called Conceptual Selling, which is about preparing for the sale, but it goes much deeper and at a higher level than some of the basic call planning programs like the Sandler program. Theirs is very, very good and a very good foundation. In conceptual selling, though, it takes you another step to really think about the types of questions that you're asking, how you ask those questions, and who you're asking them to. Because many times in a complex sale, the reason it's not moving forward is because the salesperson isn't talking to the right people. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't matter if you ask the best question in the world to the wrong person, doesn't work, right? Doesn't get you where you need to go. The other piece is the strategic selling piece, which is literally mapping on paper or now on the computer on the whole entire sale and the structure of it, right? Who are the people involved? What level of influence do they have? How will they win by choosing your product, or lose if they don't choose it, or win by choosing the competitor's product? How do they rate your solution against other solutions? And how do you navigate all of that with each of these individual people to move the sale forward? So it's really about, how am I currently positioned to get this deal closed or to lose this deal, you know, and how can I improve my position? So you map that out. You wouldn't need that in a business to consumer sale,
sure,
or a retail sale.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, one of the things I thought was very interesting about Sandler was their concept of putting an upfront contract right after the bonding and rapport stage, where you basically are gaining agreement on some kind of commitment you're going to get to move this process forward. And I don't imagine that would work all that well in a complex sale situation. Yeah.
I think, you know, some things are, you know, people say sales is part art and part science. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you talk about price and contracts and details is a little bit of the art. It's like the timing piece, mm-hmm. you know, it's sort of like doing a dance. So I think that in some sales where you want to be very transparent, like if you're selling a car or you're selling insurance or something of that nature, you want to be very transparent very early on because you don't want to spend a lot of time with somebody who simply can't move forward with you, right?
Sure.
In a complex sale, you don't always know, but most of the time, if a large company is engaging with a team of salespeople and subject matter experts and, you know, at your company, they are going to purchase what you sell. They just may not purchase it from you, right?
Gotcha.
That could be the case, you know, in any sale really, but your job then is to orchestrate them making a really good decision on which solution is going to be superior for their company. And, you know, again, you could say that would be true for selling insurance or selling cars. It's just more complex and the timing of things. You know, you also in a complex sale want to get coaching from the people you develop the best relationships with, get coaching on what's happening in their industry, what's happening at their company, what other initiatives might bump yours, who are these other people and how are they interacting? What are they saying behind the scenes? You wouldn't necessarily need to do that if you're selling one person an insurance policy, right? Because you're just talking directly to them.
Exactly. Wow. Such complexity. So let's see if we can go into a case study and maybe if you can think about a client that you've done some sales training with, coaching, whatever, however you refer to it. And maybe a client in the lower middle market space, if you can think of one. I see you have the book Traction. I know that that's super popular with my clientele. I work with a lot of contractors, real estate, property managers. If you could share a story about the type of work that you do, because I want it to be real relatable to people. And you're speaking about the complexity in a complex sale. And it makes me realize there's so much to it when, especially when you're dealing with a very large corporation and there's multiple decision makers and people and mapping all that stuff out. So does any case studies come to mind that you?
Yeah. Well, let me set the stage a little bit. So most of the companies that I work with are between 10 million and 80 million in revenues. Some are a little bigger, some are a little smaller, but my sweet spot's, you know, right in there. Mm-hmm. And most of them are owner led. Mm-hmm. Many of them are investor backed. They all sell to companies 10 to 100 times their size.
Wow.
Right? They all want to increase the value of their company, mm-hmm. either because they're going to leave it to the next generation and they want to set them up really well, or because they want to take on some investment, either debt or equity, so that they can grow more, or because they want to exit. So in every case, they want to increase their sales in order to get a higher valuation. And they're all in that middle market. And yes, almost every one of the CEOs that I work with happens to use the entrepreneurial operating system, which I, you know, strongly believe in. It's a great mm-hmm. way to help your company. So all of them selling to these much bigger companies have a complex sale. And so let me just kind of walk you through what that might look like. So I'll give you an example of a small software company that is probably about 12 million in revenues. They're about 10 years old and they sell to some of the largest manufacturers of heavy equipment like John Deere, Caterpillar, Toro, Kona, Cranes, big companies, right? Mm-hmm. Compared to them. And so they sell a software that makes it possible for the salesperson to have everything they need on a tablet, on their iPhone, on a computer, just at the ready, and with a beautiful customer interface, so they can kind of drag and drop and set up for their sales call, and then just walk on the scene and do their sales call. Now, sometimes, for example, with a Caterpillar dealer, they're out calling on construction companies, sometimes in the middle of nowhere and all over the world, and there may not be any internet, right? So this device has to work without internet. It's great, mm-hmm. fine. You can get everything you need if you can get on the internet. But why this is so awesome is because you load it up. It's beautiful. You set it all up. You sync it in the morning and then you leave, and you don't need to get on the internet again to have everything you need for every sales call ready. So sounds pretty good, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So their salespeople are out at trade shows, so that they can, you know, at big, heavy equipment trade shows like sure. World of Concrete in Las Vegas,
right?
Trying to meet the people at these big, heavy equipment companies that their salespeople have to go out in the field and call on these big construction companies to buy their equipment. So they have a very complex sale because the people who are actually going to use their product are not necessarily the people who have the final say on it, right? Mm-hmm. Because it would be sure. salespeople. Salespeople right. will have this product in their hands, the Caterpillar right. salespeople, the dealers. The boss of the salespeople, who might be a director or a VP of sales, will have something to say about it. They'll have some decision-making authority, and they might have a budget for it. But since most of them never even thought of having a tool like this, they probably didn't plan it in their budget. See how complex this is getting now?
Yes.
So those salespeople would be out talking with, at these big trade shows, they're going to talk with procurement people. They're going to talk with VPs of sales. They're going to talk with director and VP of marketing, because the marketing people are the ones that would load all this stuff up for the salespeople to have. So both, they need to talk to both the sales and the marketing people in order to complete this sale. So salespeople have to have buy-in, marketing people have to have buy-in at different levels, director, VP. And then there's probably somebody in procurement who wants to get their hands on this and make sure it's going to be a good deal. And then there may be, you know, a C-level person, a chief marketing officer, a CMO, a CFO, sometimes a CEO, but probably not in a huge company like that. But there may be a C-level person who wants to look over a purchase like this, because it's going to be deployed to an entire international sales team of thousands of people. So someone a little higher up is going to want to get involved. So my little company, my client, right? Their salespeople have to navigate all of that, meeting these people at the trade show, then finding out who else is going to be involved, and then getting them all these days on a virtual meeting. Might have been they used to have a dinner or show up at the corporate headquarters and be in a conference room with all of these various decision makers. Now they'd be on a Zoom meeting, and they have to get to know each one of these players. They'd be calling on them individually and having conversations. Then they'd be bringing them together as a group, having a conversation. And of course, at some point they have to demonstrate what their software can do and how it works. And then some people need to see that. Some of the decision makers need that. Some of them don't. And that's where, again, it gets complex, because you don't want to deliver the wrong information to the wrong people or the right information to the wrong people. And then once they've got everybody to know and understand it, then they have to navigate now, what will you pay for this per seat to have all of these people use it? And will you start with 1,000 and roll it out then after that to 5,000? And then the sale still isn't done. They've paid and they bought however many seats. The salesperson's job still is not done. They have to make sure there's user adoption on the other end of it. And that's why they have a customer success team to help with that. Because if I paid for a 2-year license for 5,000 people and only 1,000 of them use it, I won't renew my license. And so they have to continue that sale and make sure that there is user adoption. So that's what a deal looks like that I work on.
Wow. Certainly more complex than probably most of my clients are dealing with, but certainly instructive for them to drill that down to themselves. So I can understand the CEO's role in a small company, but let's say a company like the one you're describing, what's their role in the sales process? Is their job just to build the sales organization and the team and let the team do the work? Or do you see the CEOs of this company, as an example, still stepping in and being involved on the front line of the sales? Tell us a little bit more about maybe this particular client and maybe clients in general in the space that you're talking about.
Excuse me, because my puppy wants to say hello to everyone.
Oh, hi.
So, yes, I believe in every company, at every large or small, the CEO has a role in sales. Mm-hmm. It's going to different depending on the age of the company. When you're a founder and you're just starting up and you're also the CEO, of course, you're going to be probably doing most of the selling yourselves.
Right.
And if your company stays small, that's great. And you will still be probably doing a lot of the selling. But when you do start to build a sales organization, and I believe the CEO should be instrumental in that because it should be built based on the vision, values, and mission of the company, you build the sales team to support your customers. There's no other reason to have a sales team, right? Mm-hmm. And in that CEO has to make sure that they're hiring people who believe what they believe. So that's translated to the customers. So that role of building out the sales organization and being involved in it, even when there's a director of sales, a VP of sales, or even a chief revenue officer at that point, the CEO still has a role in carrying that vision forward and making sure that everybody believes what they believe and can communicate that beautifully. But another role that they have is to meet with the proper people. So for example, with the same company, the CEO of my client is not going to get to meet with the CEO of Caterpillar. Probably not going to happen, right?
Right.
That's no reason for the CEO of Caterpillar to meet with the CEO of my client. However, there may be a level that's a general manager level, or there may be some really large dealers where the president of that dealership would like to talk to the CEO to make sure that they do share similar values and they do have a bigger mission in mind together that is going to work. And so the CEO should be very well positioned by the sales people, the sales team that's doing the other work. They should say, hey, this is a place where we could bring the CEO in to have a conversation. The CEO would never be discussing products or doing demos or anything like that. At that point, they'd be talking about their vision and their mission, how you can partner together, and making the much larger company feel secure that his company can absolutely, or her company could absolutely serve them in the way that they deserve to be served. So that's a role that the CEO can play. And even in smaller companies where, you know, you're selling to a company your same size, sometimes the salespeople should get the CEOs together and have them know each other. It's important to support sales in that way.
And so
support your customer in that way.
Yeah. And so is the CEO playing an important role in customer engagement as well? I mean, and when I say customer engagement, I'm talking about getting all 5,000 users to use the software that they've just sold them. That's customer engagement, is that not?
It's user adoption for sure. And I think a CEO's message on video, mm-hmm. saying, you know, we're glad to be working with you. We know that this tool is going to help your team and we're excited and we're here to help. I think that a message like that would be amazing. But on the customer engagement side, in the very beginning of the sale, I think that CEOs play a crucial role as chief evangelist. Mm-hmm. And if the CEOs are willing, and I hope they are, to put themselves out there on social media and have some thought leadership around their, you know, their industry, the ideas that drive their company, not about their product, not about their service, not about what they sell, but about how they care about the world and how they care about their customers and how they care about their industry and what they think is coming, what the future holds, those kinds of things. So if the CEO can provide some evangelism and some thought leadership by video on events, be a panel member on a panel, speak at a summit, post on LinkedIn, any of those kinds of things is going to draw people to your company because people buy from people, not companies.
Right.
And if they see a CEO who cares, that's going to draw them in.
I think that's great. So these are the current methods that you see is using video, connecting, using social media, getting the message out, speaking from a high level strategic perspective, and trying to engage people on all levels. So that's great. Did we leave anything out? Anything else
probably
to update? Probably, right? But
you know, CEOs, again, if you're running a company of any size, and whether it's business to business, business to consumer, or retail, if people know you and know they care, they're much more likely to come to you when you can fill their need.
Right. Exactly. Let's talk about sales playbooks. How important is having a sales playbook? I talk obviously in my business about having an operating playbook, just like EOS or scaling up or one of the other methodologies. You need to have a playbook for how you're going to grow your business. What about in sales? In a complex organization selling, in an organization where a complex sale is involved, can you really put together a playbook that people can follow, or is that just too simplified?
In every case, whether it's complex or simple, put a playbook together for sales. So what does that mean? Well, it starts with what kind of salespeople do we need, right? That should be in the playbook. We may have roles, like many companies as they grow, instead of having one salesperson do the whole sale from beginning to end, they have people who do the prospecting with marketing. You know, there are some salespeople who may do some cold calling, some cold outreach, and with marketing's help, get the messaging out, those kinds of things. Then there may be a salesperson who takes the appointments and does the discovery calls, and then they bring in a subject matter expert, an SME, a sales engineer, something like that. And then there may be, they may close the deal, but then there may be salespeople who take over that account and manage it, along with a customer success team. So you first need to know what kind of salespeople do we need?
And, right.
You know, how do we touch our customer? How do we engage with our customer? So all those roles should be carefully defined. And again, at first, one person might play all the roles, and then later you'll have lots of people playing different roles.
And so before we go on, is there a bias towards having like one person who follows the whole, you know, sales process? Or is it better to have handoffs? I mean, it seems like at every handoff, the ball can get dropped, and that's where problems start to arise. Do you think that there's a?
I think things are changing, and that's a question that I could spend hours on.
Sure.
The preference is what's best for your customer.
Okay,
that's the preference. So, in some sales, when we're starting and we're just engaging with the customer, those are not going to be necessarily all the key people we need towards the end. So it likely will be important to have several different levels of salespeople involved, including the VP of sales or directors or, you know, different levels. It gets to the point with when you grow also where you can't manage all the accounts that you've landed, but somebody has to keep landing new accounts. And so that makes a logical time to split it as well. If I have enough time to manage the accounts I've landed and still go out and get new accounts, that's great. So it depends on a lot of things for each individual company. But, you know, in a small company, as you know, especially in financial services or any kind of professional services, as you know, legal or accounting, or any of those, you need to serve your customer as well as keep in touch with them, right? So that you have that relationship and you don't let go of it. So somebody always has to be in charge of the relationship and not letting the balls drop and that's making good. Sure the communication stays, right?
Right.
So again, that's part of your playbook. So what mm-hmm. types of sellers do you need is in the playbook. Right. Mm-hmm. And then who does what mm-hmm. is in the playbook.
Sure.
And then how you hire and onboard all of those different roles mm-hmm. and how you manage and coach all of those different roles. All of that should be written down. And if you don't have it written down, it will be difficult to scale. So in the beginning, we never have it written down, right?
Right.
And we grow organically and we hire a couple of salespeople and the CEO manages them. And then we hire a sales manager and the CEO manages the sales manager. And then, you know, the manager manages the salespeople and it's still not written down. And then at some point we want to scale. And or not. If you're good, you're good. That's fine. If it's not scaling, then somebody leaves.
Right.
And it's not written down. So we can't scale if it's not written down, and we can't replace people easily if it's not written down. So in either case, you have got to start writing stuff down. And I find the easiest way to start these playbooks is literally to have the person doing the job to put some stuff down, right? This mm-hmm. is what I do, and this is how I do it. This mm-hmm. is how I was trained, and this is the training I still need. Mm-hmm. And then have it evolve, you know, into, yes, we all agree that onboarding a person to be the account manager looks like this. Great. And then when we onboard the next account manager, we have them use that playbook and tell us if we missed anything. So it's ever evolving. Playbooks are not static. Playbooks should always be updated as needed. And so we develop them with the real humans that are doing the jobs, and then we review them and we use them and we continue to update them as needed.
Yeah. And so are these really written documents? Are they PowerPoint yes. slides? Are they Word documents? Where do you see them mostly?
There are companies that make software for playbooks.
No kidding. Yeah. Okay.
Right. So you can buy software and it gives you a format for your playbook, and you can have text, you can have links, you can have videos. So that's great because it's all in one place, but you could use a Google Drive or SharePoint and do the same thing. You could have a folder and you could have Word documents in there, and you could have videos in there, and you could have in your Word document, the links to take you out to the internet to different places. But in any case, we need the information to be together in a spot where everybody can get to it, and where when it's reviewed and updated, it's easy to review and update. It's still all in one spot and doesn't get spread all over the place.
So I imagine this is something you help your customers or clients with. Yes.
I'm not necessarily an expert in playbooks. There are, believe it or not, that's a whole subset of sales wow. consulting is there are playbook experts out there, but I certainly can get them headed in the right direction and looking at some software if they need it. But I think in any case, the easiest thing is just open a Word document or open a Google document and start mm-hmm. putting the stuff in there.
Right. Gotcha. All right. So as we wrap up, like, who should contact you for your services? What's the situation or circumstances that they would be contacting you, and how would they reach you?
Yeah. So it's pretty easy to reach me. You just go to alicehyman.com. If you spell it right, H-E-I-M-A-N, it's super easy, but I think right. I even have my misspelling as a redirect. So H-I-E, but so either way, but I'm also on LinkedIn, and I love to connect with anyone on LinkedIn that would like to connect. And I do post some things that would be helpful to most CEOs. Mm-hmm. And the people who should reach out to me are people who have a complex sale. Even if they're small and growing, you know, that's okay. But if you are small and selling to companies 10 to 100 times your size,
right.
if you have a longer sales cycle, if you have more complexities in what you sell, maybe you sell software or some type of hardware that's complex or some heavy equipment or machinery that, you know, is complex to sell. If you have investors or you're thinking about taking on investors and want to get your sales organization ready for that, if you need a higher valuation, those are some of the reasons that you would contact me.
Great. Alice, this was very informative. I feel like I'm speaking to royalty in the sales field. And so folks, if you are CEOs involved in companies that are scaling up and need to build a sales organization, yeah. Alice Hyman is a go-to person. So thanks, Thank Alice, you. For being with me today.
Oh, my pleasure. Love, as you can tell, I love talking about all of this stuff. So.
Yep. You're so animated. I appreciate it. All right. Folks, if you like this, share this, tell friends about this episode. If you're needing help with your sales or sales process, reach out to Alice. And thanks for joining us today on the Disruptive Successor podcast. This podcast is sponsored by myself, Jonathan Goldhill, and my company, the Goldhill Group, where we provide coaching for growing companies. I'm Jonathan Goldhill, and my purpose is simple: to guide entrepreneurial leaders in family businesses towards more freedom and fulfillment. I want entrepreneurs to get clarity around the changes that will make them and their businesses more successful so they can experience the same freedom I've enjoyed in my life. Our proven practices challenge business owners to think differently about their business and how they're running it, and quite literally become game changers in our clients' companies. Learn more at thegoldhillgroup.com website, where you can schedule your free strategy session. Thank you for joining us on the Disruptive Successor podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe, review, and share with a friend who would benefit from the message. If you're interested in picking up a copy of my book, Disruptive Successor, go to disruptivesuccessor.com.